Right, apologies for that.
Okay, now recording.
So this week we're going to talk about stars, and it's a good chance to show off some of the most amazing images from the Hubble Space Telescope. But at the same time, what I want to do is to take the chance to explain a bit about our current thinking and how stars form. Actually, these are really ideas that we've known about for quite some time. There are many areas of astronomy that we're learning new things all the time, but at least the broad picture of how stars form we've known about for many, many decades. But Hubble has still made a difference because it's allowed us to see with greater clarity and greater precision certain aspects of that process. So it's quite appropriate to feature the contribution that the Hubble telescope has made to our emerging understanding of the various stages of how stars form. And of course, one of the reasons that I thought it was a good topic to have in this first half of International Year of Astronomy was in recognition that the Hubble telescope made a great leap forward in what we could see in the skies, just as Galileo's observations had done in 1609, 400 years ago, as we're celebrating. And as I probably mentioned before, we're intending to run some Galileo-related classes in the autumn. But if we look back at what Galileo learned about stars, well, it was mainly the realisation that Copernicus had got it all wrong. We often think of Copernicus as the person that got it all right, in that he correctly helped to establish the idea that the Sun was at the centre of the solar system. But in fact, he went a bit further than that. What he really had was the Sun at the centre of the universe, and that wasn't right either. Because aside from the correct positioning of the Sun at the centre, with the planets orbiting the Sun, when you look at the details, Copernicus wasn't quite there either, because he had the planets orbiting in circles, whereas in fact we believe they orbit in ellipses. And more importantly for tonight, what he had was the stars fixed to a distant sphere around the outside, which was really the prevailing view that had existed since the time of the Greeks, for more than 2,000 years, that you had this series of concentric crystal spheres, in the view of most of the Greek astronomers, centred on the Earth, in the view of Copernicus, centred on the Sun. But in both cases, the stars were fixed onto this outer sphere, the sphere of the prime mover.
Sorry, who was it who corrected Copernicus on the stars?
I haven't said who corrected Copernicus yet. What did you want to ask about?
You were saying that the Sun not... Copernicus had seen that...
considered the Sun the centre of the universe, but what's correct is that the Sun is only the centre of the solar system.
Right.
And even that's not strictly true, because the Sun's at one focal point of a series of elliptical orbits. But, well, I kind of alluded to Galileo being the one that had a big hand in it, but it's not fair to say that Galileo was the only person, but he certainly played a major role, because what essentially was overturned was the idea that the stars were all just fixed to a distant sphere. And you know, I was hedging my bets and answering slightly, because there were some Greek astronomers who supported the idea that the stars were like our own Sun, but just very, very far away. But the prevailing belief was still, no, no, that can't possibly be true. They must just be like, you know, lamps hung in the vault of the heavens. It's one of those questions that you can argue about philosophically. It's only really when you've got a telescope and you can go out and observe that you can settle the question one way or the other. So I think if I had to name one person that helped to settle the question, then, you know, Galileo would be the one, because, as we know, with the telescope he was able to see many things that he couldn't see before. And you're perhaps familiar with the idea that he observed the moons of Jupiter, but equally important, he observed the Milky Way. And it's his observations of the Milky Way that helped to overturn this idea that even Copernicus bought into, that the stars were just on this fixed sphere around the Earth. Because, to sort of quote him here, he said that when he observed the Milky Way, he realised that it was in fact nothing but a collection of innumerable stars grouped together in clusters. So it wasn't just that the stars that we could see with our naked eye were somehow out there attached to this distant sphere that the Greeks had imagined, and which was still the prevailing view from astronomers like Copernicus. It appeared to be the case that there were many, many more stars than could be seen with the naked eye. And I guess it wasn't much of a leap from that to suppose that, well, perhaps they're all at different distances. Perhaps some are brighter than others, perhaps some are more distant than others. So, you know, that process began with Galileo's observations that when he looked through the telescope, he would see more and more stars than he could see with the naked eye. And, well, I can give you sort of no better visual impression of that, perhaps, than the wee movie I'm just about to run, which might be worth just putting the lights out for the sake of bringing up the contrast a bit better. If you don't mind, let me just do that. Oops. I'll put the lights back on again in a minute. But this is a view of the Milky Way from the Southern Hemisphere. It's from the Anglo-Australian Telescope, which is in the Australian outback. And you can see that the Milky Way, of course, is very, very bright in the sky. No street lights to worry about. And what we're going to see next, as the movie runs, is a zoom in on a portion, not the part of the Milky Way that we associate with the band of stars across the sky, but still very much part of our Milky Way galaxy. It's what's called a globular cluster. And it's a group of stars that we believe were all formed at roughly the same time. And this one is called 47 Toucanae. It's in the constellation of Toucana, the Toucan. And the final image you see there is a Hubble Space Telescope image showing individual stars. And we'll see lots more of these tonight. But I'll run it again. You just get an immediate impression that there's vast numbers of stars in our Milky Way galaxy. Over the subsequent weeks of the course, we'll look at what Hubble has taught us about galaxies, including our own. But we pretty much had a good idea even before Hubble that our own galaxy contained in excess of 100,000 billion stars. Sorry, 100 billion stars, 100,000 million is what I began to say, just to avoid the ambiguity between UK billions and American billions. Usually in science we talk about a billion as 1,000 million. So 100,000 million is, you know, a rough guesstimate of the number of stars in our galaxy. Obviously no one's counted them all, but what we can do is we can reach that estimate by sampling different regions of our galaxy and seeing how many stars you observe there. So that's the sort of canvas against which we're working. There's a lot of stars out there. Therefore, it's not really realistic to expect that we're going to be able to come up with a theory that explains how every single one of them formed. But actually, it's not as bad as you might think, because the properties that determine the behaviour of stars are actually quite few in number. There's only a few things you've got to measure about a star to really describe its properties very completely, very thoroughly. On the other hand, what complicates matters is that they are very, very far away. And because I was running a wee bit late tonight, I didn't have time to, of course, measure the width of the screen. But this was based on past experience, my recollection of how wide the screen was, and also when I've done a similar analogy in other talks. For example, in schools, they're always quite impressed by this kind of number. I think I've got that about right. The screen looks about the right width for my calculation. So if the distance from the Earth to the Sun were the width of the screen, then the nearest star on that scale would be roughly in about Rome. So, you know, there's a vast increase in distance between the distances you were talking about last week with Alec within our solar system and the distances to even the nearest stars. So to understand how stars form, how they're born, how they evolve, how they die, well, we don't have any great prospect, not in our lifetime, of going to see them up close. So it's all got to be done remotely, and therefore the better telescope you have, starting with Galileo, as I said, who brought about this great revolution in thinking just because he could see that the Milky Way contained more stars than the eye could see, well, that process continues to this day with telescopes like Hubble. Sure.
Did he assume the Sun was the same thing as stars?
To be honest, I'm not knowledgeable enough about Galileo to give you a definitive answer. I wouldn't be surprised. I know that there were various other philosophers around then, philosopher scientists, they also, you know, dabbled in both effectively. Bruno Giordano is the most notable one. In fact, I'll mention him next week because he was notable for not only suggesting that the other stars were perhaps just like the Sun, but they may well have other planets going around them. Unfortunately, he was burned at the stake for saying that. So I suspect even if Galileo did hold that belief, then he can have kept it to himself. But you know, I think you know that there was some you know ideas around in this sort of zeitgeist that you know that this was very possible. I mean, as we'll learn though, it took a very long time before the true nature of the stars, and in particular what their fuel source was, would become fully understood. I mean, you know, Galileo, I think it's fair to say, would have had not the slightest idea of what that was. Indeed, even Lord Kelvin didn't. And that's, you know, as recent as the early 1900s. So, the stars are very far away. How do we measure their distance? Well, it's not easy, but just a couple of ideas that underpin some of the notions about stars, just to kind of get us up and running. Stars shine pretty much evenly in all directions. So it's a little bit of fairly elementary mathematics lets us gauge their distance. If we knew what wattage the stars was, then you can estimate their distance by how bright they appear to be. So the reasoning there is just like how you would try to estimate the distance to, say, a car with a sort of intrinsic grasp of how bright its headlights are. Of course, you could get it vastly wrong. You could actually be thinking you're looking at a car headlight when it turns out to be the light from a bicycle as it's about to collide with your car in the darkness. So it's not advisable to judge distances based on this principle in our sort of everyday lives, but in astronomy it's often the only thing you've got to go on, which is how bright does the star appear to be, how bright do I think it really is, and therefore how far away is it. So just to flesh out the details of that, the way it works is down to something that we call the inverse square law, which a number of you, I'm sure, might be familiar with, others maybe less so. And if you think about a sphere, think about a ball centred on a little light bulb like we've got shown in the illustration here. The light bulb is shining in all directions, but if we just pick a narrow cone of directions, then you can see that if the sphere is, say, 1 metre in radius, then the light coming into that little cone will intercept a square on the surface of the sphere, which has got the size indicated in the left-hand diagram. In the middle one, what we've done is we've added a second sphere that's got a radius of 2 metres. It's twice as big in radius, but that means that the cone is now spread out over 4 such squares on the surface of the sphere. And then if we go to another sphere that's got 3 metres radius, then the same cone of light, spreading out all the time as it spreads out from the light bulb, is now covering 9 squares on the surface of the sphere. So the same amount of light is coming through the cone, but it's being spread over a wider area. So that means each of these little squares is receiving less light. Okay? We call this the inverse square law. The apparent brightness of a star falls off with the square of its distance. The number of squares intercepted by the cone is going up, not just with the radius of the sphere, but with the radius squared. So you've got 1 there, 4 there, which is 2 squared, 9 there, which is 3 squared, and so on. So this is a sort of guiding principle that can tell us whether you're looking at a very luminous star that's nearby, or, I'm sorry, a luminous star that's far away, or a less luminous star that happens to be nearby. They can both appear to be the same brightness to us, but that's because they're at very different distances. Again, just to emphasise that point in terms of a little movie. So if we've got an 1,000-watt light bulb, and we take it, I'll just let the movie run to the end, we take it 10 times further away, it will look the same brightness, it will appear the same brightness as a 10-watt light bulb would do. Of course, the other big clue we have that it's really 1,000-watt light bulbs 10 times further away is that it'll also be 10 times smaller. The trouble with stars is we don't get that extra clue because stars just look like points of light, basically, even through big telescopes, with one notable exception that we'll talk about later tonight, or possibly next week. Even the Hubble telescope doesn't show stars as a disk, as a sphere, it just shows them as points of light. So you don't get any clue as to how far away they are by how big they appear. You just get a clue as to how far away they are by how bright they appear. And therefore, you can be fooled, because if it's actually a 10-watt light bulb, then it could be much closer to you. If it's a 1,000-watt light bulb, then it could be much further away how do we know whether a star is the equivalent of a 10 watt light bulb or a 1000 watt light bulb? Well, we'll see a bit later how that works. Well, that's an example. We'll come to that later in the course. It might not be me that does that, but one of my colleagues, Fiona Spiritz, she's just finished her thesis working with me on things like supernovae, what we call standard candles. And that's all very important stuff, and so we'll come to that. But for the purposes of tonight, we're mainly just going to talk about your sort of common or garden stars, you know, 100,000 million of them in our galaxy. They're not all standard candles. In other words, they don't all have exactly the same luminosity or even close to the same luminosity, but there are still some clues that can tell us what luminosity they have, and we'll get to that. Okay, so again, just to flesh it out in terms of things that you'll be perhaps familiar with just from sort of you know, regular stargazing. If you look at the stars Betelgeuse and Rigel at either end of Orion, this is just a piece of simulation software, it's not a real image, then you've also got the star Sirius. And if you take those three, they're all roughly the same brightness. Actually, Sirius is the brightest of all. Betelgeuse, well, historically used to be a bit brighter than Rigel, we think, because the Greeks labelled it Alpha Orionis, which means the brightest star in Orion, whereas these days, generally, it's a bit dimmer than Rigel, but it's still pretty bright. But these three are at very different distances. Betelgeuse and Rigel are hundreds of light years away, light year being 10 million million kilometres, vast distance, the distance that light travels in a year, whereas Sirius, on the other hand, is only 8 light years away, comparatively on our doorstep. So if Sirius, Betelgeuse and Rigel were all 1000 watt light bulbs, Sirius would be hugely brighter than the other two. But because it's not as intrinsically bright as Betelgeuse and Rigel, it only is slightly brighter than the other two, despite being much, much closer. So these are all features of understanding stars, which nature doesn't really hand us on a plate. We've got to work quite hard to deduce these properties of stars, and as we'll see later, the Hubble telescope has played its part in improving all of that understanding. Just to give you a number or two, again, don't worry if you're unfamiliar with the notation. I've been talking about 1000 watt light bulbs. That unit of science, of physics, is what we call the luminosity, the watt. And the luminosity is the amount of energy per second given off by a body. And the sun, we talk about its luminosity as 4 times 10 to the 26. That's 4 with 26 zeros after it. So it's a very big number of 100 watt light bulbs in that sense. And it's to emphasise the fact that despite that looking a huge number, the sun actually doesn't have a terribly big luminosity compared with many other stars. If we were living on a planet orbiting another star, the sun would look either invisible or pretty nondescript unless we were within a few light years of the sun. So, you know, if there's any astronomers watching us from Betelgeuse or Rigel, they'd hardly notice the sun at all. If they were on Sirius, then, yeah, they'd notice us, but would just be a fairly dull-looking yellow star. Nothing very spectacular. And a watt, so it's the amount of energy per second, 1 joule of energy per second. It's the power needed to lift 1 kilogram bag of sugar vertically by about 10 centimetres in 1 second. And that's James Joule. And that's James Watt, and that is Isaac Newton. So, you know, these are all people who've contributed to the definition of all of these various units that we use in physics, and they're relevant both to terrestrial things like lifting bags of sugar and also to astronomical ideas. Now, the main thing that we're going to see a bit later is where telescopes like the Hubble telescope can play a major role is in giving us very precise information about the colour of stars. And the luminosity of a star can vary with its colour. In fact, it does vary with its colour in quite a precise way. Here's another image of Orion, this time a proper photograph, and a rather good photograph with quite a long exposure. So you can see the stars, you can also see some of the gas or nebulosity that's been brought out. And you can see quite clearly that Betelgeuse looks orangey in colour and Rigel looks sort of bluey white. And consequently, therefore, if we want to be more precise what we mean by the sun's luminosity, we should really add up the contributions from all colours. And we give that a fancy name, we call it the bolometric luminosity. So the number I quoted to you before, 4 with 26 zeros, watts, is actually the bolometric luminosity of the sun. The energy given off by the sun across all colours, all wavelengths of light. The brightness of the sun peaks in the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is maybe not surprising. I mean, it's probably connected with the fact that we're here. You know, we have evolved on a planet with a star whose temperature is peaked round about the right temperature to sustain life like us. We'll get into more of that in the next few weeks, because we're going to look at what Hubble has told us about finding planets around other stars. But it emphasises that if we're looking at other stars, we're looking at their colour, then the colour that we see will indicate something about the luminosity, but more importantly about the temperature of that star. So we're going to go into that over the course of the next, well, about hour. See if everyone's okay with my plan to wind up about 9. That's a bit of a long session, but then that way we can get off home through the snow. That should give me time to do sort of two things tonight to sort of set the scene for further discussion next week. One is to give you the sort of background picture of how we think stars and planets form, and then to let you see how the Hubble telescope has contributed to that understanding. How do stars and planets form? Well, we think they form from nebulae, from gas clouds. It's of course very difficult to actually see this happen before our eyes, because it takes millions of years. So what we have to settle for is seeing snapshots of it happening in different places of our galaxy, different parts of our galaxy, in different galaxies. And essentially, we've got those snapshots to piece together to give us an overall picture of how we think any given star, such as our own sun, would have formed. The other thing more recently that we can do, only within, you know, my lifetime has this been possible, is we can try to simulate that process on computer. And of course, again, you don't sit around waiting for 10 billion years for your computer program to run. You just run it in a few seconds or a few minutes or a few hours, and you're simulating a process that would run for millions or even billions of years in a matter of a few hours. So what do we see? Well, this is a slide I don't think I've showed before, but it's quite a pretty one. It's a pictorial gallery of images from a catalogue of nebulae. I think I mentioned in the first week it was compiled by a French astronomer called Charles Messier in the 19th century. And it includes a number of quite famous objects, which we'll talk about over the course of this evening. It includes a number of galaxies, which we won't really talk about for a few weeks yet, but it also includes a number of gas clouds or nebulae. They were all known as nebulae when Messier first compiled the catalogue, because back then we didn't realise that galaxies like this one were galaxies. It wasn't clear if these were just gas clouds within our own Milky Way galaxy or whole separate galaxies altogether. Again, it's the old problem. You don't know whether you're looking at something that's small and nearby or large and far away. And I'll return to that theme in a few weeks' time. But let's look at one of them that we definitely know is in our galaxy, and it definitely is a fairly small gas cloud, just a few light years across, and it looks very beautiful. But this image doesn't look exactly like the one you've seen before. This is a ground-based image. I should give due credit to the person that took it, David Malin, very famous astrophotographer based at the Anglo-Australian Observatory, who has taken many, many beautiful images, including this one, of objects visible in the southern hemisphere. And this is the Eagle Nebula. And the Eagle Nebula, these three pillars here, you might more readily recognise as the image we saw in week one, which is the famous Hubble telescope image. So the colour...
In terms of those images, the one on the right is clearly different from the one magnified. So how do you count for that? What would the naked eye see?
Well, the naked eye sadly would see really neither of these, okay, because what you're seeing in both cases is detail that the naked eye simply wouldn't see, because the way our eye works is that the retina sort of clears itself every tenth of a second or so. I think that's about the right number. Whereas both of these images are quite long exposures, and consequently you build up detail of very faint illumination light that's coming from tenuous gas clouds. That's what you're really seeing. So sadly the naked eye wouldn't see anything like either. Obviously the other feature that, you know, leads you to say that they're very different is the colour, and the subtle differences in colour can be due to two things. On the one hand, they can just be to do with the way in which the what we call a broadband filter has collected the light, and then essentially using just software you've messed with the colour balance just to bring out contrast. I mean, you could do that with your own photos if you want. You know, sometimes I've done that with you know, photographs I've taken myself, you know, if I say a sunset scene or something, I've sort of changed the balance just to bring out features. It can also be where images are taken with a narrow band filter, and that's stuff that I haven't really got into yet, but it's a good, since you know you've asked the question, it's a good point to just briefly mention it, and we'll be bringing out more of these details in the next few weeks. The red colour here is very common in many astronomy images, and it's no accident that you get that red colour, because the red colour corresponds to a wavelength of light that you get when light is emitted from inside hydrogen atoms. Hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. There's a lot of it around. There's plenty of it in gas clouds like this one. And those hydrogen atoms can become stimulated or excited when they're irradiated by light from other stars. And what that light can do is cause the electrons inside the hydrogen atoms to sort of jump up to a higher energy state. When they then drop back down again, they release that energy that they had previously gained. And electrons, you know, for details that we needn't go into in a great deal of detail now, but I will later in the course, and we know that electrons can inhabit certain energy levels in an atom, a bit like, you know, the analogy I often use is to talk of sort of, I can jump up one step or two, but I can't just decide to jump up sort of one and a half steps. That there's a fixed series of energy levels I can inhabit. So consequently, that means it's a fixed amount of energy that's released when the electron drops back down. And that corresponds to a very narrow range of colour. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, again, it depends if you just use your own eyes or if you use the filter. I mean, if I asked you to look out the window tonight, you wouldn't see very much because of the bright illumination inside this room. If we switched all the lights off, then straight away you'd start to see a bit more. But if you took a long exposure photograph with all the lights off, you would see a lot more detail. So it's undoubtedly the case that if you were on a spaceship close to the nebula, then you would still see more than you would with the naked eye from here. I mean, you know, these objects are sufficiently far away that you wouldn't see anything with just the naked eye, but if you looked through a telescope with your eye rather than recorded the image in a camera, then, as I said, you still wouldn't see this level of detail because it's too faint. But if you got close enough to the nebula, things would get better. But the specific redness that you're seeing here is more to do with the narrow range of frequencies, the narrow range of colours that the filter on the telescope is accepting. Now, our eyes don't work like that. Our eyes respond across a wide range of different colours. But actually, if you've got filters that respond to this narrow range of colours, you can see some very striking things. The sort of emission you see here, this redness, which I've just been briefly trying to explain in terms of what the electrons are doing, it's called hydrogen alpha emission. And you can get a hydrogen alpha filter for the sun, well, for a telescope to look at the sun. And what you see if you look at the sun through a hydrogen alpha filter, well, first of all, you can look at the sun because it cuts out so much of the light that the sun isn't too bright anymore. You should never, I'm sure you all know, look at the sun otherwise. But what you see much more readily than you would in broad colour is you see things like solar flares, if there are any, sunspots and features like that. So I think if I remember rightly, yep, this image here, this is the sun in hydrogen alpha. Now, okay, it's not so red, because in particular, the red colour here is mainly the result of this nebula being illuminated from behind, and then the hydrogen alpha emission is being produced when electrons are being jumped up to higher energy level and then dropping back down. But the crucial point to bring it all the way back to your original question is that the Hubble image is not with the narrowband filter, it's with broadband colours, so that's why you get the broader range of colours. So you can be, to summarise all that, you can be actually quite choosy as to how your images would appear.
It's just one of the important ways, is an iconic image.
Yeah.
In a way, it's almost a falsehood, but that's by the way.
Well, yeah, sort of, but you know, the Andy Warhol pictures of Marilyn Monroe are quite iconic, and I'm assuming she didn't look like that, you know. In a sense, you know, you adapt the colours to bring out the features that you want to accentuate. And no one's really pretended that that's what the Eagle Nebula, or at least no one in the astronomy community has pretended that's what the Eagle Nebula really looks like. But I admit, when you see it in all the postcards, I mean, that's essentially what people would think. That was a sort of rather long answer, but I think the point about the hydrogen alpha is pretty important, because the key point here is that if you see that red, you know it's being emitted by hydrogen. So this is the first step along a lengthy path that we're going to cover in the next few weeks, which is that by studying the colours of light, you can tell what chemicals are present. And that's an incredibly profound thing. You know, these nebulae, these stars, these galaxies that we'll look at, they're unimaginably distant. You know, we could never go and see them close up, and yet we can still tell what they're made of. Okay? And sometimes all you need to do that is just to look at the colours, and you can tell what they're made of. Okay? So here's just a close-up of it. And then an even more close-up of it. And what we think we are seeing here is clouds of gas which have undergone collapse. That means that they're falling in on themselves under their own gravity, and consequently have become dense and hot enough for newly formed stars to begin to shine. And you can see stars shining from within the clouds, illuminating them. And we're going to look a bit more thoroughly at just what that process involves. There's various other examples. I see there's so many of these beautiful Hubble images that I was a bit concerned I wouldn't remember all the names correctly, so I've printed off a few here just to make sure I get this one right. This one's called the Cone Nebula. And, you know, ground-based images show up the sort of conical shape a bit more. Actually, it doesn't look quite so conical in the Hubble telescope image because you see the detail. Now this one does look a bit red, but again this is interesting because this was taken later by the Advanced Camera for Surveys. If you remember back to the last couple of weeks, before Alex's class, we looked at all the different instruments that had been installed in Hubble. So this one was the Wide Field Planetary Camera with PIC-2, which uses broad filters, whereas the Advanced Camera has the capability of using narrower filters and therefore can be especially sensitive to things like this hydrogen alpha light that we mentioned. So the range of colour, you know, just from an aesthetic point of view, that you get with the Advanced Camera images is considerably wider, but there's good scientific content in that as well. Okay? Anyway, so a bit more on how all of this works. How do stars form from nebulae? Well, if we look at the Orion Nebula, that's perhaps the most famous one of all. Now this one, you know, this one does look fairly decent through a small telescope. It doesn't look as good as this image, because again, you would need a long exposure photograph to pick out the detail. But even with the naked eye, you know, it doesn't look too bad. But the Hubble telescope reveals a lot more fine detail. There's an HST image of the Orion Nebula. That's just essentially a bigger version of it. And this one is a sort of an update of the previous one. So this was with PIC-2, done in about 99 or 2000, I think. And this is the Advanced Camera image of the Orion Nebula. And this was done, I think, in 2003. So it's, you know, much more detailed. And there's another sort of detail on an even smaller scale. Yeah, now this one, that's right, is called the Swan Nebula. I knew I would never remember all the names. And that's about 5,000 light years away in Sagittarius. It's another place where stars are being born, and this is an advanced camera system image. Okay. Then final one for now, this is a close-up of the Trifid Nebula, which is quite a famous David Malan image as well, but of course you see the whole nebula in his images from the ground, and Hubble can just zoom in on a very small part of it. And make sure this is a star forming region known as N90, which is in the small Magellanic Cloud. That's a little galaxy, a tiny little galaxy by galaxy standards, which is only visible from the southern hemisphere. So the small and large Magellanic Clouds are named after Ferdinand Magellan, although of course they were well known to the indigenous peoples in the southern hemisphere long before Magellan got there, but he's gets their name, they get his name, and they are about 150,000 light years from our solar system, the small and large Magellanic Clouds. And a process that we'll discuss a wee bit later in the course of how galaxies formed, well, it's quite a violent process. It often involves galaxies merging with each other, maybe sort of tearing each other apart a bit. Often that can trigger stars forming. So the small and large Magellanic Clouds have had a fairly turbulent life, we think, often getting quite close to their own Milky Way galaxy, maybe being affected by the gravitational pull of our galaxy more violently than others, and that can trigger some of the star formation that you see in the small and large Magellanic Cloud. And here's another one, and this is in the constellation of Lynx, and this is very pretty far away compared with the Orion Nebula, but actually is very, very much brighter and has got many more new stars forming. But because it's so far away, we don't see it at all clearly with the naked eye, but is one of the richest examples of new stars forming in our galaxy. And I have forgotten what this one is, I'm afraid. Again, we're just on to sort of telephone numbers now. NGC 346, and this is another sort of gas cloud, another nebula where new stars are forming. So how does all that work? What's going on in many of those beautiful images that we've just seen, which leads me to say that it's new stars forming? Well, it's all about a sort of battle between pressure and gravity. You've got your gas cloud, and the gas cloud is subject to gravity, which is trying to pull the cloud together. Okay, just as gravity is pulling me down towards the centre of the Earth, but fortunately the ground's in the way, so I don't go any further. But if I were to jump out the window, I would realise very fast that gravity is the dominant force. Well, the gas cloud would collapse under its own gravity, except that there is a competing force that stops that collapse. In the case of here, it's the essentially the upward force from the floor, the reaction force from the floor. In the case of a gas cloud, it's the outward pressure of the gas. Now, the hotter a gas is, the more pressure it's got. So as a gas cloud shrinks, it will heat up because it's denser, and you're compressing more energy into a smaller volume. You'll generally increase the temperature. You'll also increase the pressure. So eventually you'll reach a balance where the outward pressure balances the inward gravitational force. And when that happens, you have a good chance to get a star beginning to form. But what would start the collapse of the gas cloud in the first place, with a sort of interesting little twist, is often not the birth of another star, but the death of another star. It can often be caused by the shock wave from a nearby dying star called a supernova. And we'll talk in more detail about supernovae later, either tonight or next week. But just to show you a nice few pictures of supernovae, here's just one to kick things off. Another Hubble telescope image, this time wide-field planetary camera, quite old now, this is 14 years ago, and it's a supernova in the constellation of Cygnus. This, we believe, would have been an exploding star, oh, a few tens of thousands of years ago, probably. The star would have exploded and sent shells of gaseous material, mainly hydrogen really, but with other chemicals in there as well, spreading out into space, and when some of that gas collides with other nearby gas clouds, it would disturb them and might cause them to begin to collapse, and so triggering new stars being formed. So it's the kind of ultimate cosmic recycling that the death of one star can lead to the birth of another. So it's pressure versus gravity. As I said, the more the cloud shrinks, the greater the gas pressure will be. Eventually, what we might hope would happen is that you'll get a process at the centre of the gas cloud known as nuclear fusion. And that's you got a protostar, a newly forming star going. So we'll talk about nuclear fusion in just a moment. But that's what's going on at the centre. What's going on around it is that, well, you've still got the rest of your gas cloud that's collapsing. And often what can happen is the collapse doesn't proceed in a perfectly spherical way. You know, the whole thing shrinks down just like, say, a beach ball deflating. Instead, what happens is that you wind up with a flattened structure that will collapse faster in one direction than in the others. And that's especially true if it's rotating. And the gas cloud might well be doing that, in which case you'll wind up with a kind of flattened pancake-like disk with this newly formed star in the centre. And we see numerous examples of those. Again, Hubble has helped us to image them more in a more detailed way. And this is one where, well, as you can see, the little legend, the diameter of Pluto's orbit is pretty small on the scale of this. So you could easily fit our entire solar system many times over comfortably inside one of these. And yet we think our whole solar system formed out of something very much like this. So there's a lot more shrinking still to happen. But in addition, of course, our solar system does go out a long way even beyond Pluto. I don't know if Alec talked about the Oort cloud last week, but you know, the comets and the Oort cloud, many of those have orbits that extend hundreds of times further out than Pluto's. So you're looking at, you know, something which by and large could be just like our own solar system in its entirety. Star at the centre, gas and dust cloud around, out of which planets, comets, the whole lot could form. Here's some more. Now this is an image taken with NICMOS. Remember, that was another one of the second generation instruments, near infrared camera. Now dust is very good at glowing in the infrared. Infrared colours of light have wavelengths a bit longer than red, and those correspond to temperatures which are a bit cooler than a red star. We'll say more about that shortly, but again, you've probably got a good sense of that from, say, you switch on the ring on a cooker. It'll glow red. First of all, if you leave it on for long enough, it might start to change colour, maybe sort of orange, orangey, yellowy. If it starts to glow blue, then you should probably evacuate the kitchen. But stars are like that, they have a progression from red through to blue. Remember Betelgeuse and Rigel that we saw on Orion. So infrared disks are actually quite cool in the sort of literal sense rather than the cultural sense. Although the latter probably applies too, because again you're looking at sort of new star systems. If we believe that our own solar system formed out of a big gas cloud which collapsed, the sun began to shine at the centre, and then slowly but surely the gas cloud cleared, then what you're seeing here is the gas cloud still in the process of clearing. Therefore, sooner or later, you might find some planets in there. Unfortunately, we can't stick around to see that happen, because it might take millions of years. But this is a snapshot of other systems going through the same evolutionary stages that we think our own solar system did in its earliest times. So what's all this nuclear fusion about that I mentioned then? So remember, the idea is that the gas cloud shrinks, and as it shrinks it heats up. So in the centre of the gas cloud, what you've got is a very hot gas, which eventually becomes hot enough to allow the process of nuclear fusion to occur, which lets stars begin to shine. Now, the reason why that only happens at very high temperatures is because nuclear fusion applies to the nuclei of atoms, basically hydrogen, at least at first. But we'll talk about other forms of nuclear fusion later. So a hydrogen nucleus is a positively charged particle called a proton. Hydrogen atom consists of a proton and an electron. The proton's positively charged, the electron's negatively charged. Now, positive charges repel each other. Negative charges repel each other. It's just a positive and a negative that will attract. So if you try and bang two protons together, they're going to repel each other because they're both positively charged. And the force that repels them is known as the Coulomb force. It's the force of electromagnetic charge. But there are other forces at work inside atoms. There are strange forces that we call the electroweak and the strong nuclear forces. And if you can overcome this Coulomb repulsion, then eventually if you can get the protons close enough together, they'll actually start to attract each other. So a good cartoon picture for that is to think of there being a kind of a barrier that you've got to overcome. If you think, suppose you were trying to get over this barrier on a motorbike or something, if you take a good run at it, then there's a good chance you might get up the hill and over the barrier. If you don't go very fast, then you won't get over. So, what you need in order to overcome the Coulomb barrier is for the protons to get very close together at very high temperatures so they've got enough energy. Now, I'm simplifying this a bit. There's some fascinating detail I'm leaving out because actually we think that the weird rules of quantum physics play a role here, that actually what you wind up doing is quantum tunneling your way through the barrier, but there isn't really time to get into the details of that. But, I'll see if I possibly can in a subsequent week. But the broad picture is just as I've described, that if you've got enough energy, i.e. if the protons are hot enough, then they can overcome their natural repulsion and they can fuse together. So that's why nuclear fusion only happens at high temperatures, despite what was claimed about 20 years ago when some rather naughty physicists and chemists were claiming that they'd done cold fusion in a test tube. And there are still occasionally, claims that crop up that, oh no, they were right all along. But basically no one has been able to reproduce those results. If you could do fusion at room temperature, it would solve all our energy problems. But fusion is a way to get a fantastically powerful source of energy. That's how the sun does it. But it does it by banging protons together at 20 million degrees. And that's a bit hard to do in a test tube. So basically nuclear fusion only occurs at high temperature. I nearly said nuclear fusion. So that's basically what's going on. So it's this battle between pressure and gravity. And when the pressure gets high enough to balance the gravity, it's also the case that it's hot enough to allow nuclear fusion to happen in a star like the Sun. And that nuclear fusion process is going on all the time in the Sun, and every second 600 million tons of hydrogen is converted into 596 million tons of helium. And the missing 4 million tons gets turned into energy. According to our famous equation, E equals mc squared. Now the speed of light is the c there, and you're squaring it, and the speed of light's already a very big number, so c squared is even bigger. And speed of light, according to Einstein, is the ultimate speed limit in the universe. It's a very high speed, 300,000 kilometers per second, or 300 million meters per second. And therefore, that's basically saying that every kilogram of hydrogen produces a colossal amount of energy. If we express it, this is per second it's happening. So C squared would be 9 times 10 to the 16, 1 kilogram, so that would be 9 times 10 to the 16 watts, but there's 4 million kilograms every second, so you're well on your way to getting the 4 times 10 to the 26 watts that we talked about as the luminosity of the Sun. So the point is, to link this back to a wee bit of history, I mentioned a bit earlier that even Lord Kelvin wouldn't have had a real idea of how the stars shine, far less Galileo. That really is true, because up until Einstein came up with these ideas that allowed us to envisage nuclear fusion, we didn't really know of any other chemical or physical process that could produce this much energy from that little mass. Therefore, Lord Kelvin was really puzzled by this. How could the sun shine with such a high luminosity and still last for billions of years, as geology seemed to be suggesting because of the age of the Earth? So that was a real puzzle until ideas from relativity and quantum physics helped us to explain that stars could shine by this process of nuclear fusion. So although 4 million tons a second sounds rather wasteful, there's a lot of tons in the sun. It's 2 times 10 to the 30 kilograms, that's 2 and 30 zeros after it. And there's 1,000 kilograms in a ton. So that means that the sun should be able to shine for something like 2 times, well, let's not worry about the factor of 2, 10 to the 27 seconds, which is, you know, billions and billions and billions of years. But it's not quite that simple because, as we'll see, once a certain amount of the hydrogen has been used up, then fusion stops. It's not that the sun can use up absolutely all of its hydrogen. It can only use up a fraction of it. But the basic picture is that the sun can keep shining in this way for a very long time. Okay? Right, now, I'm mindful that some of this is involving maybe a bit more sort of physics ideas, astrophysics ideas. I want to mix it up a little bit through the course, but I'm not going to dwell too much on some of these big numbers and the sort of complicated formulae and things. We'll keep it mainly just to a simple sort of qualitative description. But it is important to stress that the observations give us the qualitative picture, and then what they've helped us to do is to build a detailed quantitative theoretical picture of what's really going on in a star. But back to the observations for a bit now. See how we're doing? Yep, 8:30. So I'll stop in just a minute, see if we've got any questions, and then we'll do another session. And just through to about 9. So let me just now mention what will be our main focus for the next section, which is that the idea we mentioned earlier of stars having different luminosities and different temperatures, we can flesh out the ideas a bit more. We can make a kind of graph of stars. We can plot their luminosity, and this is on a scale where the sun is just 1, so the sun's luminosity would be here. Or another way that astronomers can represent that is called the absolute magnitude. So if you've heard of that before, there it is, but if you've not, don't worry, it's just a different scaling that astronomers use. And then we can measure also the surface temperature of a star. Now that's quite difficult to do directly. We obviously can't take a thermometer and do it, but we can deduce it from things that we can measure directly. We'll see a bit more about that as we go along. But another way that we can characterize the surface temperature is using a more direct measure, which is just the color or the spectral type of the star. So the sun is a yellow G-type star, and it's got luminosity 1, which puts it about here, on what's called the main sequence. And that's where the vast majorities of stars lie. Stars spend most of their life in the main sequence, and the vast majority of stars will inhabit the main sequence for many billions of years, some for a considerably shorter time. After stars have left the main sequence, then they might inhabit on this color magnitude diagram what's called the giant branch for a while, or even the supergiant branch. Eventually, stars like the sun will wind up becoming what we call white dwarfs, and we'll talk through the details of that in a moment. I emphasize again that for any given star, you don't see any of this actually happen because it takes too long. You just see snapshots at different stages. But the picture that we've put together by looking at stars of all different ages and at all different steps along that evolutionary process is that any given star will be born on the main sequence, will spend a certain amount of time on the main sequence, turning hydrogen into helium by this process of nuclear fusion, and then eventually will leave the main sequence and may even wind up becoming something like a white dwarf, or actually something even weirder, a neutron star or a black hole. more on that to come. So this idea of the main sequence, let me just put up a couple more slides and I'll pause. I'll put some real stars on this time, just so you can see where real stars belong. There's the Sun, more or less where I said it would be, at luminosity equal to 1, because that's on the scale we're using, and it's a G-type star with a surface temperature of about 6,000 degrees. So the temperature at the heart of the Sun is many millions of degrees, but at the surface, it's about 6,000. And remember what I was saying earlier about the progression going from red to blue? Blue is hot, red is cooler. A reddish star like Betelgeuse would have a surface temperature of maybe 3,000 degrees. A bluish star like Rigel would have a surface temperature up near the 20,000 mark, as you can see indicated. And there's a number of other well-known stars that you can see there. Now notice that the luminosities range quite a bit. You've got a star like Betelgeuse, which is very highly luminous, but quite cool. Whereas you've got another star, some of you might have heard of this one, called Barnard Star, which is a red dwarf. Very low luminosity, that's because it's not very big, but it's got a similar colour to Betelgeuse. So there's still the opportunity to get a bit confused. You could be looking at a star of a particular colour, and unless you know whether it's a high luminosity star or a low luminosity star, that will make a big difference to your deduction of how far away it is. But if it's a star in the main sequence, then basically measuring its colour is good enough to tell you what its luminosity is. Because you measure its colour, if it's a main sequence star, then it's just somewhere on this red line. And that means you can work out roughly how far away it is, because you know if it's a 1,000 watt light bulb or a 100 watt light bulb. So that's roughly how the process works. And the reason why stars spend so long in the main sequence is because while they're there, they're doing this fusion process of converting hydrogen into helium. And stars can generally do that for a very long time. Stars like the Sun, at least, can do it for billions of years because there's a lot of hydrogen available. And it doesn't use up the hydrogen all that quickly. You know, 4 million tons of hydrogen a second sounds like a great deal, but in fact, it will last for a long time. So that's the big picture, that we think that stars form out of gas clouds. We think that they spend a large fraction of their lifetime in the main sequence, and that also because there is this main sequence, this sort of region where most stars can be found, that provides us with very important clues that can tell us how far away stars are, because we know from a measurement of their colour how luminous they are. Okay? Does anyone get any questions then? I've been talking for a while. So.
One of your images shows red giants and super giants.
Mm-hmm. I'll go back to that one, sure.
And there seems to be a gap between them. Is there have explanations for this?
Yeah, pretty much. We'll get into that probably next week before we're into that. But what I'm going to talk about next week is how we can use data from the Hubble telescope, actually. And of course, we could do this before, but Hubble's been really useful in improving the quality of data we have to measure the ages of star clusters, and in particular to track the evolutionary tracks of individual stars. As I said, you can't see a single star going through that whole evolutionary lifetime. But what we've been able to do is build theoretical models of where stars will spend time on this diagram, and then you try to match up the stars in a particular cluster with those theoretical models, and that will tell you whether the cluster is 5 billion years old or 6 billion or 7 billion. So the theoretical models involve how sort of stars will behave when they leave the main sequence, and basically they have the opportunity to become supergiants if they were massive enough to begin with. But these are fairly broad classes.
Giant or supergiant?
Supergiant.
Right.
You know, it's not an exact science. I mean, aspects of astronomy are extremely exact, but this is just nomenclature. I mean, you know, I'm struggling to think of an analogy. We might choose to define a city as having more than a certain number of people. I know there are other ways you can define a city and a town as, you know, less than that number.
The
but
the problem is defining the planet.
A bit like that, absolutely. You know, and we've chosen to define Pluto as a dwarf planet. That's a better analogy, actually. It's also astronomical. But, you know, there's not that much difference in size between Pluto and Mercury. In a way, what's more important is not so much the difference in luminosity as aspects of what their eventual fate might be. And as we'll see, I think it'll be next week before we get there, if a star like the Sun leaves the main sequence, it will become a red giant. That's just a label we happen to give. I mean, it isn't as big as a red supergiant, but, you know, whether you call it a supergiant in a way doesn't matter. The important thing is that the end state after that is very different from a star like Betelgeuse, because a star like Betelgeuse can become a supernova, whereas a star like the Sun isn't big enough to become a supernova. So I think that's the more important distinction. So generally we reserve the term supergiant to relate to those stars whose eventual end state may well be a supernova.
And there's a gap between the two.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that it's only a cartoon. I think if you look at all those 100 billion stars, you would probably find that there is stars occupying the whole of this diagram. Essentially, the key feature we'll come to, it's more subtle than just, you know, a gap in the diagram. It's to do with what the stars are actually doing in the main sequence itself. Let me leave you with this, because, see, we won't get into it this week. I've referred to this PP chain. I didn't see what that was. The PP chain is when fusion occurs from protons colliding with other protons. Okay? So that's how it works in the Sun. In a more massive star, the way in which nuclear fusion occurs is fundamentally different. It involves carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen rather than just hydrogen. So basically, the key feature that will ultimately affect whether a star can become a supernova or a white dwarf isn't how big does it get when it becomes a supergiant, it's how massive was it to begin with and what sort of fusion can it undergo. Okay? So the more meaningful way to relate that to the diagram is to say, well, as you go down the main sequence, what's actually changing is the mass of the star. And when you get a certain way down, the star isn't massive enough and isn't hot enough to allow this carbon, nitrogen, oxygen CNO cycle of fusion to occur. And that inevitably means that it won't ever become a supernova. So hence it wouldn't be a supergiant. Okay, so that's kind of how the distinction's made. But there isn't really a gap in the main sequence. You know, it's a fairly sudden switch from hot enough for CNO cycle to being too cool for CNO cycle. So consequently, that, you know, the diagram is going to be pretty well populated. The gap is shown here. You know, maybe that's a bit misleading.
Well, can I just confirm my understanding of the diagram? So in order to set up the diagram, there must be some kind of way to independently verify distances.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you look around the local, your local stars, the ones you can use, some other technique, that allows you to get down with the absolute maximum or luminosity. And then from that you can infer.
Absolutely. No, that's an excellent point. I should say that, because, you know, the reason I wanted to stop now was to make sure that I sort of got round all the relevant questions before plowing on with too much more. And that's a very good point, which I probably should have said more about earlier. I was commenting how knowledge of the luminosity allows you to estimate the distance. But how do you know the luminosity in the first place? And as you say, what you do is you sample nearby stars where the distance can be obtained in other ways. And I haven't got slides on this tonight because I was going to leave it for a few weeks yet, but I can sort of easily demonstrate the effect. If I hold my finger up, many of you will have seen this sort of thing before, and I cover first my left and then my right eye, the finger appears to shift with respect to the folks in the background. That's what we call parallax. And if you think of the unit of distance that we've been referring to mainly up till now, we've been talking about the light year. But actually astronomers more often use another unit called the parsec. It even features in Star Wars. Han Solo talks about the Millennium Falcon doing something in less than 12 parsecs. So
did
it's...
He used it in pregnancy.
He did indeed, absolutely. And legions of Star Wars fans for decades have puzzled over whether it was just a straightforward blunder or whether there was some hidden meaning, I'm not sure. But it shows that the term has sort of made it out into, sort of popular usage. Light year's still probably more common, but the parsec is quite an important term as well. It's short for parallax second. Now, a second of arc is 1/3600th of a degree. There's 60 minutes in a degree, and there's 60 seconds in a minute. So it's a way of measuring angles. It's a bit different from just degrees. It's just a finer scale for measuring angles. So, think again about the finger and me covering the eyes. As the Earth goes round the Sun, we're looking at nearby stars from a slightly different point of view. In June, say, compared with December. So, we can measure the distance in units of parsecs, where the parsec is defined as follows. A star is said to be 1 parsec away if between December and June it undergoes a shift that corresponds to an angle of 1 second of arc. I'll show you the pictures in a couple of weeks that will sort of maybe flesh out this a bit better. But what this emphasises is that for the very nearest stars, we can actually measure the distances very precisely. We use it using, sort of trigonometry, like all the stuff we learned at school, but the properties of right-angled triangles. We don't need to make any assumptions about how bright they are. All we do is look at the tiny shifts in position of the stars compared with much more distant objects over the 6 months of the year. The first parallax measurements were successfully done in the mid-19th century, so it's, it took a long time before this was possible because the shifts are tiny. The 3600th of a degree, well, that's about an 1800th of the width of the full moon. So, you're not going to notice this very easily. But if you measure it precisely enough, you can pick up the parallax shifts, and that gives you very accurate distances to nearby stars. That means you can put their position on this, it's called the Hertzsprung-Russell, or color magnitude diagram. I'm not even sure if I said that before. I should have done. The diagram we've been looking at is called that. You can plot the positions of those stars very precisely. And then that can help you to build up distances to more distant stars by the comparative properties of the ones you've got reliable distances for, and then you compare those with the more distant ones.
What sort of error are we looking at with parallax?
Oh, really tiny, just a fraction of a percent. Well, depends. The further away you go, the more error prone it becomes. But within a few hundred light years, the latest observations, we have very accurate distances. There's a number of satellites have contributed to that. There was one mission called Hipparchos, was launched in the late 1980s, which made a huge leap forward just by measuring parallax distances to thousands of nearby stars. Perhaps I can show you some pictures of that next week. I didn't think to include them tonight. And there's another mission that's planned for the next few years called Gaia, which is going to measure parallaxes to more than 1 million stars in our immediate neighbourhood. Still only a few thousand light years away, but that's hugely increasing the distance over which we have very reliable parallax distance measurements.
Can I ask, within the profession as such, do you use light year as a term of distance?
No, I would use parsec. Actually, to be honest, most of the time I use megaparsecs,
right,
because working in cosmology, the distance unit that's more sensible is millions of parsecs.
Right, so
because
yeah. Light year wouldn't be mentioned.
Not really. Not really. Not that we have anything against it. It's just that there's sort of technical reasons why the parsec is a more natural unit. It's to do with the fact that we've got this funny unit here called absolute magnitude. Well, the other... But remember, absolute magnitude, I only mentioned just because it was there on the diagram. I didn't want people wondering what it was. But I said the thing you should really think of is luminosity. So luminosity is an intrinsic quantity. A 1,000-watt light bulb is still a 1,000-watt light bulb, regardless of whether it's in front of your face or 5 miles away. But how bright it appears to be will be very different in those two cases. So similarly with a star, the absolute magnitude is an intrinsic measure of its luminosity, but how bright it appears to be we measure by what's called the apparent magnitude. Okay, you might have heard that term before. Now, if you measure distances in parsecs, then the relationship between apparent and absolute magnitude is very simple. If you measure it in light years, it's less so. And then the other thing that I've spent a good chunk of the last 15 years trying to measure is a number called the Hubble constant, which is a measure of how fast the universe is expanding. And the units we measure that in are kilometres per second per megaparsec. Again, you could express it in per million light years, but it would be a different number. And we've just kind of got used to measuring it that way. Yep. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, right, good. Let's just see if we can say a few things about... actually, if you don't mind, just let me check, because I want to see... Yeah, that's grand. I didn't want to be hitting you with too much of the physics and the equations, and indeed that's not the case. There's just another couple of slides, and then we're back to setting it in a more appropriate astronomical context. But what we see here is a bit of a cartoon, like many of the slides are, of course, of the proton-proton chain. This is the fusion reactions that are going on inside the Sun. So just let me walk you through this as to what's going on. Over here at the left, what you see is two hydrogen nuclei, two protons, which are colliding together. Now remember we said that how that comes about is by it being very, very hot. The temperatures are hot enough to overcome the repulsive force that they'll feel, and they stick together. But it doesn't really happen very often. Any two typical hydrogen nuclei might take as much as a billion years before they finally get around to fusing. So it's a very slow process. And in a way, that's just as well for us, because if the Sun used its nuclear fuel up much faster, then there wouldn't have been enough time for life like us to evolve. So in a way, the long time scale for nuclear fusion in a star like the Sun is very closely linked to the long time scale for evolution of life on Earth.
Is that billion years at the time from when the gas cloud started to collapse, or when it's a proton star?
No, really, once the star started to shine, I mean, essentially, it's not to say that, I mean, obviously, there'll be fusion happening all the time, but this is a bit like the calculation one often hears about. You talk about the half-life of a nuclear isotope. It means, you know, typically what's the length of time for half of it to decay? And this is, in the same way, it's what's the typical time scale for half of the hydrogen to fuse would be a billion years. But this is after the star has begun to shine as a protostar. The next step's interesting, though, because that would be happening elsewhere nearby in the star. You would have another two hydrogen nuclei fusing. But then what happens is that it only typically takes another second for another proton to get in the act. So the reason is that what's formed by the first two banging together is a different sort of hydrogen. It's called deuterium, sometimes known as heavy water. And you get deuterium inside nuclear power stations as well, although it contributes to a different sort of nuclear reaction called nuclear fission. But what you see here is that the deuterium is rather unstable. It will much prefer to then collide with another hydrogen nucleus and form not hydrogen at all anymore, but a form of helium. So it's helium because it's got two protons and one neutron. That might only take another second. So the deuterium hardly lasts for any time at all. Then you've got helium-3. And then maybe another million years would be the typical time scale for the helium-3 to merge with another helium-3 nucleus to form helium-4. There's four things there, two protons, two neutrons. And what's left over, because you had 3 and 3, you get 4, and two single protons left over, they're now free to go off and start the whole thing again. So you can get, as we know, we use the phrase, a chain reaction. And the funny little squiggles that are coming off here, that's gamma radiation. It's light, in other words, very, very energetic light. So the whole process is self-perpetuating, forms a chain reaction for as long as there's a good supply of hydrogen around, and also it produces energy. So this will keep going for a very long time in the Sun. There's another few bits and bobs that are given off. These are called positrons, these are called neutrinos. They don't really matter. The key ingredients are the radiation that's given off, the energy that's given off, that's what gives us the heat and light from the sun, and also the protons that start the whole process again. So that's what's going on in the sun, and cooler stars in the sun are doing just the same thing. Much hotter stars in the sun use up their hydrogen much faster than the sun does. So the time scales that we saw here of billions of years are much, much shorter for massive stars. Blue stars, they're more massive, they're more luminous, they're hotter, and they use up their fuel much, much more quickly. So let me just end with a couple of pictures, and then we'll see if there's any more questions to wrap up for tonight. This is a slide put together by a former colleague of mine that decided to set up his own freelance company doing artwork for magazines like Sky and Telescope, and he's written a few popular science books as well, where he's also done the artwork. And it's a, you know, fairly simple painting, but it gives a very nice sense of what's relevant here. We've got the Earth, we've got Jupiter, we've got our Sun, and we've got a blue supergiant star, like maybe Rigel would be a good example. And you can see the range of scales. The Earth is, well, you could fit about 300 Earths inside the planet Jupiter. And Jupiter, you could fit about 10 Jupiters across the diameter of the Sun. And perhaps the Sun, you could fit maybe as many as 1,000 Suns inside of Rigel. So, there's a range of scales in size from planets which don't shine by themselves, but even the stars which do shine by themselves come in various sizes, exactly various shapes, because they're all still round, but they come in various sizes. And the hotter stars, like the blue ones, like Rigel, they're burning their hydrogen much faster via another cycle, which I mentioned earlier, called the carbon-nitrogen-oxygen cycle, the CNO cycle. Stars like the Sun...
Can you say the blue stars are much bigger
then, generally speaking? Generally, yes. If they're on the main sequence, or if they're supergiants that have left the main sequence, then they're going to be bigger. Yep. You can, however, and you know, again, it's quite timely you've asked the question, because I don't really want to go too much into the CNO cycle tonight. We'll pick that up next week. But if you look at the diagram, you've got a few stars down here. Sirius B is a blue-white star, but it's a white dwarf. It's a lot smaller. Essentially, what Sirius B is the core of a massive star. It's all that's left behind. The outer part of the star has been blown away. Not perhaps in a very dramatic event like a supernova explosion, but something a bit more gradual. And we'll look at some beautiful Hubble examples of that next week, photographs of what are called planetary nebulae. So generally blue stars are hotter. Well, they are always hotter because that's what makes them blue, but they're generally bigger. But sometimes you'll get small, very compact, low luminosity, but just as hot blue stars as well. Okay? So just to summarise then, we've got these two processes for lower temperature stars like the Sun, all the way down to reddish stars like Barnard's star, red dwarfs. The nuclear fusion process that's going on is the PP chain, hydrogen colliding with other bits of hydrogen, and forming helium, whereas for more massive stars, as we'll see next week, it's still hydrogen being converted into helium, but it's via a sequence that involves, as a catalyst, okay, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. So that's the word that I first learned about it anyway in chemistry class. It's where you've got some chemical element or compound that helps a reaction along. It doesn't directly contribute to it, but it helps it along. And the carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen that are often present in a very hot star can help the burning of hydrogen to proceed at a faster rate. Okay, so we'll pick up the story of that next week. If everybody's okay with me stopping, it will just ensure my safety driving home. And I'll just leave you with a couple of nice images. What you see here is a globular cluster. So remember the movie we saw at the beginning, which was zooming in on a cluster of stars that we believe would have been formed around the same time. And these are clusters in the Small Magellanic Cloud, NGC 265 and NGC 290, just as getting catalogue numbers. And these are thought to be pretty young because they contain lots of hot blue stars. And another very good example of that is the Pleiades. Now, I haven't got a Hubble telescope image of that because, to the best of my knowledge, no one has ever been taken. The Pleiades, you can see with your own eyes, you can see with a small telescope, you don't need Hubble to look at it. The Pleiades is a small cluster of nearby stars. In fact, one of the projects I've worked on in the past is trying to measure its distance. It's using the parallax method that we discussed before. It's about 400 light years away, and it perhaps is about 65 million years old. So the way I often like to put it is that when the dinosaurs were around, they would have seen the Pleiades star cluster still in the process of forming. So the Pleiades has got lots of hot stars in it. So do these. They have to be young because the hot stars don't last long. So if you see a cluster with hot blue stars in it, unless they're white dwarf stars, we'll get to the details of that next week, if they're biggish stars and they're blue, they've got to be young, because otherwise they would have burned themselves out. So that's a key to an idea that we'll explore more next week, which is that you can look at the colours of stars and you can work out the age of the star cluster. And the Hubble telescope has been really useful for that. It's given us much more precise ages than we ever had before for clusters of stars.
Why are they all young and blue? Is there a special thing about the cloud that makes them that?
No, that's a very good question. Well, first of all, the fact that they're all quite young is just connected with the fact that they would have all formed at roughly the same time. And in a sense, you know, right, they could all have formed at the same time and all be old, but as soon as there's at least one of them that's a blue star, then that immediately tells you that the cluster as a whole must have still had some star formation happening quite recently. As to why they should all be blue, well, that is a good question. We're not always so clear on that. Essentially, how we think it works is that when the gas cloud begins to collapse, it will fragment into smaller pieces, each of which will become a star. And that's where things like these computer simulations can be a good guide. They can try to tell us whether you would reasonably expect all the bits that fragment to be roughly the same size, in which case they'll form a star of the same mass, which will have the same temperature and colour, hence they all wind up being blue, but they could equally all wind up being yellow stars, or so on. What more often happens is that you get a bit of a spread. So again, you know, when I talk about the Pleiades, it will often be said that the Pleiades is a cluster of hot young blue stars. It's got a preponderance of hot young blue stars, but there's actually more than 1,000 in the cluster. We call it the Seven Sisters because there's seven that are brightly visible. There's lots of littler ones which aren't so hot and aren't so blue, but still formed at the same time. So what you usually do get is a spread. Okay? Indeed, we'll see more of that next week. And there's just a zoom in on another one. And I'll need to check I've got the name right. Well, again, the names don't mean much to me. They might not mean much to you either. This is NGC 1850. It's located in the Large Magellanic Cloud, then one of our little neighbouring galaxies. And it's thought that this perhaps was created during a supernova blast. So that's the filamentary structure of gas that was expanding outwards from an exploding star a long time ago. And as that ripple of gas passed through a big cloud of gas that used to be over here, what it did was it started lots of stars forming. But you know, it's quite difficult to deduce all this from just seeing a snapshot, but it's all consistent with the picture that we have. And essentially there are actually two clusters here. There's the bigger one, which has got a good spread of some yellow, some even reddish stars, a few blue ones. But this one down here is a very tight, compact cluster of extremely hot blue stars. So they really would have all formed at the same time, and indeed all of roughly the same mass and temperature. Okay, so I'll stop there if that's okay, folks. I'm glad my voice held out, and thanks as ever for all the very good questions. So there's a bit more to cover in stars, and that will also lead us, hopefully seamlessly, into a discussion of planetary systems. We'll return next week after we've said lots more about stars to images like this one, where you see stars with disks of gas around, and we'll look at how Hubble has helped us to understand how planets form, and indeed helped us to find some real existing planets around nearby stars. Okay?
Not really directly.
There's a couple of images which are spectra, which show features in the spectrum which are light that's been absorbed by the planet's atmosphere. So, you know, it's, I suppose technically it's still indirect, but it's pretty clear evidence that the planet is there, and we're over what the planet's made of. That's one of the things I'm going to feature next week. Thank you.
Is it one big supernova that tells two stars?
Thanks. You're welcome, thank you.
A
type 1A supernova. 1B and 1C are just single isolated stars, well, we think, core collapse, but they've got various other properties to do with how much hydrogen they have in their spectrum. The 1As are the only ones which are thought to be binaries, and it's a red giant with a white dwarf companion, and the white dwarf gets pushed over what's called the Chandrasekhar mass limit. We'll talk about that in a few weeks as well. Okay. Good night.